Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Discovery Institute, Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. Today we have on our show with us a very, very fascinating guest, Mr. Michael Flannery, who is Professor and Associate Director for Historical Collections at the Lister Hill Library of Health Sciences at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Mr. Flannery is a native of Cincinnati, Ohio. He holds a master's degree in library science from the University of Kentucky and a master's degree in history from California State University, Dominguez Hills. He is also quite an accomplished writer. He's written 7 books. In 2001, he won the prestigious Edward Kramer's Award for Distinguished Writing by an American from the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy, and he also won the 2006 Publications Award of the Archivists and Librarians in the History of Health Sciences. This past February, in honor of Darwin's 200th birthday, he actually published a piece in Forbes magazine online titled Alfred Russel Wallace, where he discussed how Alfred Russel Wallace had a very different view of evolution than Charles Darwin, even though the two of them basically co-discovered the theory of evolution by natural selection. And how over time, Alfred Russel Wallace came to a somewhat different position than Darwin, something that might be of interest to those of us who are proponents of intelligent design. And so this leads us to the reason why we have Mr. Flannery on the show with us today. He recently authored the book, Alfred Russel Wallace's Theory of Intelligent Evolution, How Wallace's World of Life Challenged Darwinism, which is an absolutely fascinating read for those of us who are interested in really the history of evolutionary thinking and the history also of intelligent design. So, Michael Flannery, thank you very much for being on the show with us today.
Thank you, Casey.
Well, your book is published by Erasmus Press, and I want to talk about your book, Alfred Russel Wallace's Theory of Intelligent Evolution, How Wallace's World of Life Challenged Darwinism. Is it available on Amazon.com, or where is this book available?
You can get it at Amazon.com. Just do a Google search under Erasmus Press, and there's a direct link to the press webpage, and you can get the book that way as well. So either Amazon.com will do, or Erasmus Press.
Okay, great. Well, let's first start off talking about you a little bit. What got you personally interested in the debate over evolution and intelligent design? Obviously, your background is in library sciences. So what got you interested in this debate?
Well, you know, like most college students many years ago, more years than I care to remember, I did read Darwin's Origin of Species, but it never struck me as particularly convincing. The religious implications really didn't bother me, since back then as a student, I just didn't think about such things very much. But it always struck me from the beginning that Darwin's title never really delivered on its promise. And its real promise should have been to explain how species first originated, and I never got that out of the book. So from the beginning, it sort of left me somewhat puzzled and, if nothing else, disappointed. It seemed to me that all Darwin showed was how species adapted and modified themselves to their environment, and the rest struck me as pretty doggone speculative. So then about the same time, I stumbled upon a book published years ago in the 70s while I was still in college by William Irwin Thompson called At the Edge of History. And I realized that at that point, I wasn't the only one who questioned Darwin. Thompson basically said that the human mind was inexplicable on Darwinian principles and that even today, this question remained unanswered. And so Thompson didn't really say what the answer was, but it was clearly not explained by Darwinian evolution. And, of course, years later, I read Philip Johnson's book, Darwin on Trial, and then I said to myself, yeah, now this makes sense. But my real eureka moment with ID came from reading William Dembski's Intelligent Design. And I think at that point, I sort of began to put the pieces to my own puzzle together and saying, you know, from what I had read as a student, this intelligent design theory made a heck of a lot more sense.
So, Mr. Flannery, pardon me, actually, you have a background in both library sciences and in history. So how does this background that you have give you a unique perspective on the evolution and intelligent design debate?
Well, my approach is essentially historical, and my background, is in history. I've spent most of my career in the history of medicine. I am a librarian as well, so the sources, the resources of history are important to me. I'm involved in special collections and have been most of my professional career, but that dovetails well as a librarian with my interest in the history of medicine and a broader interest in the history of science. I believe that tremendously important work is really being done on the science side by investigators like Stephen Meyer, Michael Behe, William Dembski, Jonathan Wells, many, many others. But I'm not sure that the historical roots of intelligent design have been thoroughly studied. Tom Woodward wrote a good recent history of ID in a book called Doubts About Darwin, which I highly recommend. It's a very good book. But he really only goes back essentially to the 60s, the famous Wister Institute Symposium, and so on. I wanted to know the deeper historical roots, and that's when I really discovered Alfred Russel Wallace.
So, in your book, Alfred Russel Wallace's Theory of Intelligent Evolution, you actually start off talking quite a bit about Charles Darwin and how he had a certain personal history in terms of his own ideological development before he came to his theory of evolution. So, why is it important to understand Darwin and his own personal background before we understand Wallace?
Well, I think before we can appreciate Wallace, we need to get him out of the glaring radiance of Darwin, and I even sort of put it in that context in my introduction. You know, I mean, really, so much attention is heaped upon Darwin that I think we lose sight of the fact that Wallace was a 19th century naturalist of significant importance in his own right. We need to quit analyzing everything by the benchmark of Darwin and Darwinian processes. And once we get away, once we step away from that, other thinkers, other scientists begin to emerge as distinct figures in their own right. And that is, of course, especially true of someone like Wallace.
It's almost like the current hyper-commitment to neo-Darwinism within certain factions of the scientific community plays out in history, where they ignore certain figures who have ideas that, say, aren't supportive of the current paradigm. I mean, you write in your book, quote, Darwin's genius, Darwin's revolution, Darwin's legacy, Darwin's science, Darwin's rigor, Darwin's insight, all falls upon the eye and ear with the tiresome repetition of a mystic's mantra. What did you mean by this when you wrote this in your book?
Well, I mean, you read and hear so much praise heaped upon Darwin that you begin to wonder, really, if anyone is looking at the man and his ideas with any kind of objectivity whatsoever. It's almost as if praise is bestowed by the oft-repeated consensus rather than any carefully examined results of his life or work. Instead of critical inquiry, what we typically get are scenarios where tough questions are dodged, problems are explained away, special pleadings are offered, or any number of evasions are given in place of a more demanding bar of evidence. So I say, let's stop it. Let's start critiquing Darwin instead of serving as rubber stamps for anything that bears his impress.
I'd like to talk a little about some of Darwin's past, stuff that you don't necessarily hear about when you read about history of Darwin and biographies of Darwin. He was very involved, as you talk about in your book, in the Plinian Society when he was in school. What was that and how did that influence him?
You know, once you start looking at Darwin's life carefully, you begin to realize that his claim that he merely was following the evidence wherever it led was really so much boilerplate. Darwin wanted to portray himself, and this is important to give some context to this, that Darwin wanted to portray himself as this dispassionately objective scientist, but his experience at the University of Edinburgh is revealing. Darwin was something of a frustration for his father, who frankly was pretty disgusted at his son's singular devotion to idleness. His father referred to it as shooting, writing, and rat catching. So his father, hoping that his son might follow in his own steps and that of his grandfather, Erasmus, decided to send him to the leading medical school of the day, and that was the University of Edinburgh. He came there with his older brother in October of 1825. He was 16. He stayed there until April of 1827, and he absolutely hated it. But the one thing he did love was studying nature and science, and he petitioned for entry into this Plinian Society in November. He was admitted, and there he came under the influence of some of the, what back then was called free thinkers, some of the most radical free thinkers of the day, and some of them were even his fellow students. Let me just give a flavor of what he was exposed to. The very meeting at which he was admitted into the Plinian Society, he heard fellow student William Brown attacking Charles Bell's essay on the anatomy of expression that was published in 1806, in which Brown scoffed at Bell's argument that human expression particularly was specially endowed by a creator. Now, Brown dismissed the idea as, in his words, anatomical chauvinism to suggest any unique difference between human and animal anatomy. Then he heard, I'm talking about Darwin now, heard William Gregg give a talk that concluded that the lower animals possess every faculty and propensity of the human mind. Now, if that wasn't enough, he then heard a talk that argued for the mind and consciousness as being a merely a matter of brain activity. And this time, it was once again given by the irascible William Brown, and this talk was considered too radical for the public record, and so it was actually struck from the Plinian Minute Book. None were as influential, however, over Darwin as fellow Plinian Robert Edmund Grant. He was a man 16 years his senior who was an expert on aquatic invertebrates and a passionate and, more importantly for Darwin, experienced naturalist. The mentor and protege, they soon took long walks together discussing everything from nature to animal development to, just all manner of topic. Now, Desmond Moore, in their biography of Darwin, which is now more than 10 years old, refer to this, and they actually discuss Darwin's activity in the Plinian Society, and they also refer to his meeting of Grant as a decisive meeting for Darwin. And Darwin, they say, and this is a quote from them, was coming under the wing of an uncompromising evolutionist. Nothing was sacred for Grant. As a free thinker, they add, he saw no spiritual power behind nature's throne. The origin of evolution, of life, were due simply to physical and chemical forces, all obeying natural laws. This is a quote from them. Darwin's handling of this relationship here is pretty disingenuous. If you read his autobiography, he mentions the fact that Grant at one point began to wax eloquent on Lamarckian evolution, but Darwin's suggestion in his autobiography is that it had little effect upon his mind. In other words, it made no impression on him. Now, here Darwin, I think, is trying to distance himself from the truth of the matter, and namely that he had a long relationship with such ideas. He had long known about the theory of evolution, and its materialistic implications were clear to him, implications that Grant surely laid out to the teenage Darwin. Now, none of Darwin's major biographers buys this either. Janet Brown, who recently authored a kind of a magisterial two-volume biography of Darwin, says this is far too disingenuous to take at face value. Now, Ben Weicker's new biography, The Darwin Myth, an excellent biography of Darwin. In fact, if you really want a complete biography of Darwin, that's the place to go. It's a great piece of scholarship. He points out that Darwin's own family roots were steeped in radical skepticism, three generations worth. His own grandfather's Zoonomia, which was published back in 1794, I believe, was an early attempt at presenting an evolutionary theory, and it's quite clear that not only did Darwin make a careful study of it, but he also read Anne Seward's 1804 biography of his grandfather, a largely praiseworthy effort on Anne Seward's part, hailing the praises of Erasmus Darwin. My point in all this is to point out that virtually every major theme that would surface in Darwin's mature work, he had already been introduced to as a youth. This family background, and I think especially his experience with the Plinian Society, gave him, a template through which he would view all of his subsequent data in nature. Well, what exactly was this template? Well, it was materialism, the idea that the only thing we can know, the only thing that counts, is the physical material world. Its implications were clear. It wasn't that methodological naturalism proved there wasn't a God. It's that God just didn't matter. In a sense, God was irrelevant. My point is really to echo Howard Gruber in saying that Darwin amassed his so-called evidence long before his views were quite well developed. So here's the bottom line on Darwin, at least as I see it. Darwin's theory of evolution is really a theory of materialism supported by a series of biological speculations. That is to say, it's first and foremost a metaphysic supported by a veneer of selectively constructed science. So that's my view of the early influences of Darwin and really why they made a difference and why it's important to keep those in mind as we look at his theory.
Well, this is very helpful for us to know about Darwin's early life and some of the strong influences that shaped his own intellectual growth. I think we don't often hear about some of these. And I think it's also important for us to understand the differences between Wallace and Darwin. And we're going to probably get into that more in the next podcast. But I'll just say this right now, Mr. Flannery, is that as I read your book, one of the things that struck me is how Darwin's view was that his theory of natural selection had to apply to the origin of everything. Nothing was to be exempt from his, you know, as we now have seen it called, universal acid. Whereas for Alfred Russel Wallace, he was willing to take a more tentative scientific approach and say, well, sometimes we will most certainly invoke natural selection acting upon random variation when it's the best cause. But there are other places where it might not be the best cause, and we shouldn't just assume point blank that natural selection is the appropriate cause in all cases. We should test it in a case-by-case basis and apply it when it's appropriate. And to me, that sounds like the way that a scientist should operate. They shouldn't assume that a particular cause is at work in all cases, but they should test and they should measure and they should tentatively invoke a cause every time they feel it's appropriate, but not simply almost take a metaphysic that says, oh, this is the way it is all the time. And that to me really shows the metaphysical difference between Alfred Russel Wallace and Charles Darwin, in that Darwin actually had a stronger philosophical motivation to what he was proposing because of how he would apply natural selection blanket across the board to so many different things.
Absolutely, yeah, I agree.
Well, I think we're going to get into this more in the next podcast. So stay tuned, folks, for more with Mr. Michael Flannery, author of Alfred Russel Wallace's Theory of Intelligent Evolution, How Wallace's World of Life Challenged Darwinism, published by Erasmus Press. You can check it out on Amazon.com. So, Michael Flannery, thanks for being with us, and please come back for more.
Thank you very much, Casey.
I'm Casey Luskin with the Idea of the Future podcast. Stay tuned for more with Michael Flannery.
For more of Dr. Michael Flannery on Wallace, our listeners in Seattle should join us this Tuesday, October 5th at Discovery Institute, where Professor Flannery will be speaking. Visit www.discovery.org for more information. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute, 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.